Good morning. On today's programme, the new Prime Minister of Czechia faces a difficult balancing act as his new coalition between populist, conservative and Eurosceptic political parties is formed tomorrow. And as international relations break down between Afghanistan and Pakistan, India is stepping in to take advantage. First, though, to Syria. 1 year on from the fall of Bashar al-Assad, Syrians gathered across the country to celebrate the end of a brutal regime. However, underneath the obvious joy for the new government, questions remain about the country's future. The Syrian economy has been destroyed by the civil war, and the rebuilding of its towns and cities will require billions of euros. Sally Hayden reports.
In every direction, people were celebrating. Across Syria last Monday, they hung from car rooftops, danced in the streets, cheered and beeped horns, sang revolutionary songs, waved or wore the new Syrian three-starred flag, and set off fireworks. From 5:30 a.m., mosques broadcast a special chant. Less than an hour later, 6:18 a.m., marked exactly a year since it was announced on national TV that dictator Bashar al-Assad had fled and the regime had fallen. December 8th has been christened Liberation Day. After more than half a century under the Assad family, a lightning rebel offensive led by Islamist militant group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham saw the regime collapse in just 11 days. 1 year later, Syrians are still growing accustomed to their new reality, which remains far from fully defined. Interim President Ahmed al-Shara has gained widespread praise in the years since for engaging internationally, including through meetings with US President Donald Trump and a speech in the UN General Assembly. We went from being a country that exported crises to a country where we have an actual hope of delivering stability, he said last week, later declaring the beginning of a new chapter, the chapter of rebuilding the nation. The Assad regime's fall came after nearly 14 years of a war that killed around 500,000 people and forced more than half of Syria's population from their homes. Between 2011 and 2024, more than 200,000 civilians were killed by the Assad regime, according to the Syrian Network for Human Rights, and more than 160,000 people disappeared by it. When it fell, tens of thousands of Syrians descended on former prisons, detention sites, and mass graves, searching for any evidence of their missing loved ones. Hundreds of posters of the missing lined walls in public places. Many got no answers. Bashar al-Assad remains in exile in Russia, and it is uncertain whether he will ever face justice. During a recent meeting with members of the Caesar Families Association, who found their loved ones among leaked pictures of detainees tortured and murdered by the regime, those present stressed that they would like to see justice carried out by Syrians themselves in a Syrian court. One elderly couple, whose son was killed in a regime prison, told me they can be patient, but not too patient. After 3 or 4 years, they will take justice into their own hands, they said. Questions also remain regarding the future of minorities in the country, and whether the new government can find a way to embrace all of its citizens. These concerns were underlined by a series of incidents and crises this year. In March, attacks against the new government forces by pro-Assad insurgents sparked retaliatory massacres of civilians in the coastal regions, targeting the Alawite sect, of which Assad was a member. In July, there was an outbreak of violence in the southern city of Sweida, between Druze and Bedouin armed groups, which saw Druze civilians massacred. In June, a suicide bomber targeted a Christian church in capital Damascus, killing at least 22 people as they prayed at Mass. Christians are afraid for their future. They don't know what's going to happen next, said Father Johanna Shahada, who survived the bombing. He said communication from the new government has not been clear enough, meaning parishioners must pay attention to rumours on social media, increasing anxiety and their sense of unease. Along with everything else, Syria is going through an economic crisis. Last October, the World Bank estimated Syria's reconstruction costs at 186 billion euros. The country's economy was destroyed by the war and international sanctions, which are now beginning to be lifted. At the same time, there's Israel, which has been accused of encouraging instability by carrying out bombings, incursions, and seizing land in southern Syria. Despite all of this, for many Syrians, the anniversary symbolized a chance to properly celebrate the freedom that so many gave their lives for. Syrians abroad even came back for it, some after more than a decade away. in the Kaldia neighborhood of the city of Homs, which was once under a crippling siege by the regime, thousands of men, women, and children sang revolutionary songs last Sunday beside what was once a temporary cemetery used because people trapped there could not leave to bury their dead. The atmosphere was euphoric, attendees noted. "I'm feeling so good right now," a woman said, grinning widely. Attention turned to us, the foreign journalists, most of whom were barred when the regime was in power. "Welcome to Syria," people from the crowd called. "Welcome to Homs." For World Report, this is Sally Hayden in Syria.
Next to the Czech Republic, where billionaire businessman Andrej Babiš was appointed as the new Czech Prime Minister this week, the second time he's held the job. On Monday, the president will appoint the rest of Babiš's cabinet, a coalition between the populist ANO movement and two smaller conservative and Eurosceptic parties. There's been much speculation as to the direction the new prime minister will take the country in, especially over Europe, and where he will stand in support for Ukraine. As Rob Cameron reports.
Andrej Babiš cuts a distinctive figure, tall, slightly hunched, with a buzz cut and a rather monotonous, long-suffering voice. He carries the wary, watchful expression of someone who spent half a lifetime in boardrooms and the other half bored to tears in Parliament, an institution he's often dismissed as a talking shop. When he loses his cool, his native Slovak comes to the fore and his Czech becomes peppered with mistakes. But that's not often these days. Andrej Babiš is pretty pleased with himself. For a start, he is now the first prime minister in Czech history to serve two separate terms in office. At 71, he is the comeback kid. This week, Babiš, the smooth diplomat, was on full display as he flew to Brussels for the first time since winning the elections in October. Always media savvy, he posted a photo from Prague Airport on Facebook, clutching a modest travel bag. The caption read, "Well, time to fly then." There were more social media posts once he arrived, presenting Ursula von der Leyen with a bunch of flowers ahead of their meeting, one of several high-level tête-à-têtes in the EU capital. Journalists crowded round him when he emerged. This is, after all, a man who railed against Brussels and the EU during the election campaign, a man who co-founded the sovereigntist Patriots for Europe with Viktor Orban of Hungary. He's attacked the European military aid given to Ukraine and has sought to undermine the highly successful Czech ammunition initiative. But he was quick to present a different face to reporters, batting away claims he would be part of the EU's awkward squad alongside Viktor Orban and Robert Fico of Slovakia. "No," he said, "the Czech Republic would be a very constructive partner and would seek alliances across Europe to further his country's priorities." On Ukraine too, Babiš has softened his language. He no longer talks of scrapping the Czech ammunition initiative that has delivered literally millions of shells to Ukraine's artillery batteries. Instead, it will be reviewed rather than dismantled. There have been unconfirmed reports this week of long meetings attended by President Pavel, US officials and NATO representatives, beseeching the incoming prime minister not to scrap it. And observers believe he will broadly stick with the mainstream EU policy on the war. But where Andrej Babiš might dig in his heels is climate policy. He's long derided the EU's Green Deal as green suicide. His deputy says Prague will simply refuse to implement the EU's new emissions trading scheme, which could set up an almighty clash with the European Commission. Though he may not have to rattle his sabre over the EU's ban on new petrol and diesel cars, as Friedrich Merz seems to be doing that for him. The real geopolitical theatre, however, is playing out along the spine of Central Europe in what remains of the once influential Visegrad group, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary and Poland. Babiš's election victory was celebrated with great enthusiasm in Budapest and Bratislava, raising hopes among nationalists that Visegrad might be reborn. "Another patriotic government in Central Europe," Hungary's foreign minister crowed. "Not so fast," say analysts. "Visegrad 3, maybe. Visegrad 4, not so much. Poland's new president, Karol Nawrocki, even cancelled a planned meeting with Viktor Orban over the latter's latest overtures towards Vladimir Putin. Without Poland on board, and Prime Minister Donald Tusk is even less keen on his Danubian counterparts, there's no prospect of a Visegrad revival, whether Andrei Babiš is on board or not. For World Report, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
Finally, to India, where the government in New Delhi has begun courting Afghanistan's discredited and regressive Taliban leadership. This follows a rupture in relations between Afghanistan and Pakistan, once close allies, but who have recently engaged in armed attacks. India is now making the most of these hostilities and befriending the Taliban it once hated. This new dynamic is rewriting diplomatic relations in turbulent South Asia. Sajida Momen reports.
A bizarre diplomatic courtship is underway in South Asia, which has geopolitical and geostrategic ramifications for the region and beyond. The world's largest democracy, India, is passionately wooing Afghanistan, whose regressive Taliban government is not recognized by a single country in the world. The contrast is striking, also in terms of population and religion. India is the world's most populous nation, while Afghanistan is ranked 36th population-wise. India is predominantly Hindu, and Afghanistan is 99.7% Muslim. Despite all these glaring contradictions, it is not difficult to gauge why Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist government is pulling out all stops to cultivate what's probably the world's most isolated and shunned regime at present. In a sense, India has achieved the impossible by nurturing good relations with Afghanistan, as Afghanistan has traditionally been a trusted ally of Pakistan, India's enemy number one. Since their birth in 1947, India and Pakistan, which are nuclear powers, have fought three full-fledged wars. This year, too, they fought aerial battles for 4 days, shooting down each other's fighter jets, before US President Donald Trump forced them to sign a ceasefire agreement. Currently, Pakistan-Afghanistan ties are at an all-time low, even as India-Afghanistan relations are unexpectedly blossoming, proving that there are no permanent friends or enemies in geopolitics. Until recently, Islamabad had successfully blocked rival India's attempts to spread its wings in Afghanistan, thanks to Pakistan's Inter-Service Intelligence, or ICI's, hold over the Taliban. Between 2001 and 2021, the Taliban was out of power and fighting US forces in the Afghan government, backed by Western troops. But even during that troubled period, the Taliban targeted the Indian embassy in Kabul and consulates in Jalalabad, Herat, and Mazar-e-Sharif, killing Indian diplomats. Not surprisingly, New Delhi had openly denounced the Taliban as a Pakistani proxy and a terrorist outfit working against India's interests on Islamabad's instructions. When the Taliban recaptured power in August 2021 after the US withdrawal, a panic-stricken India promptly left Afghanistan lock, stock and barrel, shutting all its diplomatic missions and evacuating all Indians to keep them out of harm's way. At that time, Pakistan called the shots in Afghanistan, and it appeared that India had been elbowed out of Afghanistan for good. India's complete marginalization in Afghanistan really blunted New Delhi's influence in South Asia, to Islamabad's great delight, which it made no effort to conceal. But soon enough, in a strange geopolitical twist, relations between Pakistan and Afghanistan, run by the Taliban, which Islamabad had mentored and patronized for decades, began to sour and turn bitter. Their ties nosedived as Islamabad repeatedly accused the Taliban regime in Kabul of harboring armed groups like the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, or the TTP, which were wreaking havoc in Pakistan from Afghan soil. As the rift between Pakistan and Afghanistan hardened over TTP's deadly operations inside Pakistan, India began to woo war-ravaged Afghanistan, first with wheat, medicines and other developmental assistance, and slowly with diplomatic support for Kabul as it took on India's arch-enemy, Pakistan. Recently, the armed forces of Pakistan and Afghanistan fought pitched battles, and the once friendly Muslim countries callously bombarded each other's civilians, killing women and children. Turkey and Qatar's interventions have come to naught, and all peace negotiations have hit a wall because the two countries seem determined to fight to the finish instead of peacefully ironing out their differences. On the other hand, ties between India and Afghanistan are on the mend. New Delhi has reopened its embassy in Kabul, and there are increasingly frequent high-level engagements with the very same Taliban, which India once characterized as an international pariah. In October, Afghanistan's Foreign Minister, Amir Khan Muttaqi, came on a six-day visit to India, the first by a Taliban leader after the group seized power in 2021. It was a path-breaking visit, resetting relations between once estranged India and Afghanistan. In November, Afghan Minister for Industry and Commerce, Alhaj Nuruddin Azizi, came to India for 6 days. A spokesman of India's External Affairs Ministry described Azizi's visit as a successful and productive one with very good outcomes. He extended an open invitation to Indian businesses to set up shop in Afghanistan and promised them tax holidays and other incentives to attract investments. The success of New Delhi's Afghan diplomacy and how it has become a headache for Islamabad is evident from Pakistan Defense Minister Khwaja Asif's assertions in a recent television interview after peace talks between Afghanistan and Pakistan collapsed. He said that the TTP mounting attacks in Pakistan from Afghan soil has been penetrated by India. He also said that the Taliban leadership responsible for the escalation in tensions with Pakistan is controlled by New Delhi, which wants to engage in a proxy war with Pakistan. India has rubbished the claims as Pakistan has not cited any evidence of New Delhi's involvement. But there is no denying that India has turned the tables on Pakistan by engaging purposefully with the Taliban, which Pakistan once used as a weapon against India. For World Report, I'm Sajida Momin in India.
That's it from World Report for today. The program was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or find us on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Ethna Dodd, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.